Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And good to have you here with us as we switch gears here to Annapolis. On our way there, I want to remind you that this conversation, conversations like this, are brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, has been helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. And remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We are going to take a look at what's happening in Annapolis in this segment of the Mark Steiner Show, and good to have you with us here for this conversation. Joining us by phone is Brian Sears. Oh, did we just lose Brian? He was there and gone. He'll come right back. Government reporter for the Daily Record. In studio, Dr. Natasha Pratt-Harris, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Morgan State University, and Charles Robinson, political and business correspondent for Maryland Public Television. Good to have you all in the house.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number to join in on this conversation. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, send an email to talk@steinershow.org. Join our Facebook pages, which I'll check, but do call in at 410-319-8888 and talk about what we may think are some of the biggest issues facing where the battles will be drawn here. And one battle line, Brian, you're back.
I am back.
Good, good.
Brian's back?
I thought it was something I said.
No. I thought it was something I said.
But you haven't said anything yet, Brian.
Well, that still could be a problem.
Brum, bum, tsch. And welcome to the Mark Steiner Show, State Comedy Hour about politics. So sometimes it does feel like a comedy, sometimes not. But let's talk about, Brian, let's begin, but I want you all to kind of throw out for us, and I have my own list here, what you think are going to be the issues that are going to dominate and cause the biggest debates between the governor and the Senate and the House and more in these next 2 months.
You want me to start?
Yeah, please.
I think that there are a number of bills that are on the governor's agenda where clearly he has taken an approach that Democrats favor. One very big ticket item in particular would be the paid sick leave bill, which is significantly different than one that that passed the House of Delegates last year. And is going to be sort of the skeletal structure of the public policy that the legislature is going to work on trying to pass this year. And I've had a number of Democrats, including Senate President Thomas B. Mike Miller, who have told me that the governor's proposal is 100 miles away from where the legislature is. But I think you're going to see a lot of talk about that. I think you're going to see a lot of talk and debate about the governor's bills on transparency and ethics reform. Already that has sparked some conversation with the Senate looking to put in an emergency bill to deal with its own ethics issues, to deal with the ethics on its own, through its own piece of legislation. And I think it's going to be all Donald Trump all the time. I mean, we started seeing that immediately after the president was elected. And you had a number of groups, including Democrats and groups that typically support Democrats, like the State Teachers Association, that immediately came out and tried to tie the governor to Donald Trump at every turn, and that continues, and I believe shows no signs of abating.
And also, it may be tough to do, but we can talk about that as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, that actually is a topic probably we should discuss, and I think you probably saw the first example of that in the State of the State last week.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that before the hour's out, though. I think that's a really important discussion. I think that's going to be people gearing up for this 2018. Natasha, where do you see the major battles being?
Well, coming from a CJ criminal justice perspective, I would assume that part of his approach will be to address what's happening in the state of Maryland, in Baltimore City, particularly regarding our policing policy, criminal justice issues, criminal justice reform, the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services, the new youth jail that is being built, and what the state, like the Department of Juvenile Services, will be doing regarding that particular facility, and engaging in local discussions relative to how funding is set aside and or reorganized for the new youth jail, and then cuts had been made to the educational system, public educational system. And we know here in the city particularly, school systems are dealing with major deficits, and you know, the climate nationally kind of speaks to people paying attention, understanding more of the issue from a popular perspective. So pressure coming down from the coming up, you know, from the people to Annapolis to address these real pressing issues. We're seeing, protests. We're seeing commentary. We're seeing more engagement with people going down to Annapolis to address these very things. And it's not something that can be, not a priority on his agenda. So we shall see.
So you want me to start?
Yes, I do. But what do you think?
Well, you know, I'm going to respectfully disagree with all of y'all. Okay. I know Brian won't find that funny. But first and foremost, I think there has been a unique power shift that's been going on in Annapolis. First of all, the influence of the Baltimore Metro delegation, and I'm talking about Baltimore City and Baltimore County, has been diminished, and the power shift has gone to the Washington suburbs. With that said, I want to point out a couple of things that are not on everybody's radar and that you want to watch. The Legislative Black Caucus this year has a new agenda, has a new chair. That's Delegate Cheryl Glenn, and she is upset specifically as it relates to the Marijuana Commission,
right,
and its awarding of individual licensees, if you will. And they've made it a priority either to want to reopen that process and or expand that process. But in addition to that, there are a number of questions as it relates to the money that the state is receiving from all of the casinos around the state. And if you remember correctly, that most of that money was supposed to be targeted at education.
Yep.
And because it's now going into various pots, and Brian can speak to this as well, that these pots are kind of staving off what a lot of people would consider massive layoffs, furloughs, and so forth. But the problem,
Charles, let me jump in on that, because one of the things that there is a misconception about this, and it's something that was widely reported in 2012 when these bills came out. There was no language in these bills that specified that any specific amount of money was to go to the education trust fund over and above the percentages that were put in, and nothing that sort of ramped it up. And so there were all these commercials that ran from, you know, people like the building trades and other groups that supported it. County Executive Jim Smith was in one of these commercials, you know, touting this as saying, you know, money is going to go to education, mm-hmm, and this money, right, is going to help children, and making it sound like this was, you know, craps for tot. And in the end, like, it was widely reported by a number of us, including me and the Washington Post and the Examiner, that there was this missing language in here. And so, you know, when the Baltimore Sun story came out a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm, and it noted this language, I mean, I watched on social media as people sort of grumbled about this, but it was not even remotely a well-kept secret. Everybody knew that there was enough wiggle room in here to drive a Brinks truck through and put the money into the general fund. And that's exactly what has happened.
Right.
So let me just jump in here, because I think that to pick up on this, unless you're going to bring another subject up.
I wanted to hone in on this a little bit more.
So let me do this for a second. So we've raised a number of issues here, folks. I want you to join us at 410-319-8880. Let's talk a minute about education and casinos, mm-hmm, and where that and I think that you hit the nail on the head, Brian, when you said we talked about this on the air at the time it was happening, mm-hmm, when the vote on the casino was happening as a referendum.
Which one, the first one or the second one?
The issue was that we were being sold a bill of goods by the advertising, mm-hmm, saying this money is for education, yeah, which, right, is why I should vote for casinos, mm-hmm, which is why the vast majority of people, I think, voted for the casinos.
Exactly. Right.
But from all the polls that were taken, mm-hmm, that's one of the motivations people had for wanting to vote yes. Mm-hmm. It was so you it was there that you to pay for education, but only in the amount that was already required by law, not to add to money for education.
Right.
And the rest would be going to the general fund. So there is the rub. I mean, so people, you know, I think, and when you said, Brian, that you could drive a truck through it, and that was always the reality. The problem is that was the reality for the people in Annapolis in the General Assembly debating it and arguing it. They understood
Mark,
that.
Mark, I disagree.
And the majority of people did not understand
exactly.
that.
Exactly. The people don't understand
100%.
It.
This was widely reported,
no.
and voters who supported this bought a bill of goods. They bought slick advertising that said that this was money that was going
right.
to go for
yeah,
kids.
Yeah, we don't disagree.
Nobody,
right.
And nobody bothered to read the stories, and nobody bothered to read whether or not these things were true, and nobody bothered to read the bill, and they voted for something because it sounded good. Mm-hmm. And this is slick messaging over what was actually in legislation. I just respectfully disagree with you.
Wait, what'd you say, Natasha, then come back to you. But I mean, just Brian, recall, well, where do you think we disagree? Then I'm going to go right to Natasha, then over here to my dear friend, Charles.
I think people voted for this, but this outrage. This outrage 5 years after the fact, as if nobody knew. In the end, they voted because of slick messaging, and they voted because they hoped that people would do the right thing. And memories outside of Annapolis are ridiculously short. Nobody sort of looks at this and goes, well, if it's not in legislation, that means that any other thing that can happen probably will happen. And when the state needs extra money, that extra money is not going to go to education. It's going to be moved into the general fund. And look, that's exactly what has happened, because there was nothing specific in the legislation that made it any different.
Now,
this idea that people are sitting outside of Annapolis and they don't understand, this is not the first time that wiggle room has been built into bills that all of a sudden allowed legislators to have flexibility to do things.
Yeah. And again, the common voter may not have been aware that it even wasn't a part of legislation, but it wasn't like the overwhelming majority of people voted for the casinos. Many people were skeptical about what the advertising even said regarding casinos, just like what the advertising said regarding the Maryland State Lottery some decades ago that didn't trickle down to schools in a capacity that allowed them to say, okay, this is something great to vote for in terms of allowing for this type of industry to take over the state of Maryland and, be a part of the landscape of downtown Baltimore in particular. So it is about the average voter, and it is about the average voter not being a politician, not necessarily going down to Annapolis, not reading the great reports written by these great journalists about something that impacts them directly. So it goes beyond it being widespread knowledge. It's about whether or not that information really got to the people, or if the people actually understand the politics regarding how you get someone, or how you get a policy, or how you get a bill passed, or how you get someone in office.
Well, let me say that one of the reasons why I brought
Charles
this
Robinson.
Up was this idea that there is a, if you will, a bubbling underneath the surface that's going on with communities such as Baltimore City as well as Prince George's County. I hear it from the county executive in Prince George's County, Rusher and Baker, as well as some folks in Montgomery County. They're asking why? The question is, can they coalesce around either a piece of legislation to change that formulaic formula? Because understand, it's the Thornton formula that all governors have to follow, okay? Which divvies out money to the various jurisdictions. But there in Baltimore City, I've heard it from Delegate Antonio Hayes and others who have argued that, well, if they're making all this money, how come we aren't getting some of it? The problem continues to be is, do you have a piece of legislation to address it? And you hear a lot of argument, but you don't hear a lot of people putting stuff on paper and saying, I think this is a way to make it move in a general direction. But that's an underlying. I think this whole idea that the governor of this state, Larry Hogan, who enjoys a some people say above 70%
right.
popularity, he feeds into this whole idea that I'm just not your regular GOP operative.
Mm.
He's played that for all of its worth. Brian and I joke oftentimes when we're in Annapolis together that losing is winning.
I never joke with you, Charles.
we joke that losing is winning. And a prime example of that was this past week in the veto override of the Green Energy Bill, that even though Larry Hogan lost, he won because this idea being that he can go, understand, Larry Hogan didn't have a big campaign over the air, but he had it on social media. And now he can go back to his constituents and say, I tried, but I need help.
But he also, I think that Brian, in many ways, Governor Hogan is also the master of, in some, like anybody else in politics, a kind of subterfuge in terms of messaging, of making things very simple, you know, calling it the roadkill bill.
Was the roadkill bill.
Or whatever else. Coming up with things that kind of make people.
The sun tax. He called this one the sun tax.
Yeah. You know, so I think that he's good at that.
Look, he is very good at that, and he's also very disciplined in his messaging. And just real quick, I want to slide back to the education thing, because there's one component of this that we didn't talk about that I think is going to make this whole casino gambling thing really relevant coming in the future, is that within the next couple of years, we are really expecting to see something coming out of the Kerwin Commission that's going to look at expanding funding formulas for education, much in the way we saw Thornton do in 2002. And if you remember, you know, the Thornton formula, when it was fully phased in, was about a $1.3 billion plan for extra education funding that had very little funding sources in the budget beyond the first year, and really can be tied directly to, you know, the $1.3 billion structural budget deficits that we had going in to Bob Ehrlich, you know, in the Bob Ehrlich's term. And so, you know, at $1.3 billion when it was fully phased in from a 2002 plan, I mean, some of the numbers that we've heard, I mean, one of the numbers that I got from a legislator came in at around $6 billion. I mean, that is a budget choker. And where do you come up with $6 billion? I don't think anybody.
$6 billion over a period of what time?
You know, I haven't seen the full phase in on it. But, I mean, this will be over a number of years. You know, Thornton, I think, was phased in over 5 or 6 years.
Right.
So, I mean, we are talking about a number of years, but, I mean, like, if that $6 billion number is accurate, and this one legislator who was a Democrat seemed really skeptical and, to be honest with you, really irritated that this number would even sort of be thrown out. I mean, where are you going to come up with billions of dollars? And one of the answers might be jiggling the percentages that the state collects from the casinos. As you know, Mark, and as I'm sure the other panelists know, I mean, all of those things are subject to negotiation and changes at the whim of the legislature and the governor. And so the deal that you had now or 5 years ago may not necessarily be the deal that you have in 3 years.
So let me open the phones here. I do want to come back to Baltimore, the questions of policing, mm-hmm. and also money for education, where that reality will live, mm-hmm. And what that debate will look like, Cheryl Glenn's argument around marijuana, and also obviously to look at the paid sick leave, which is going to be, I think, maybe the center debate going on between the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansion. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner. But guys like yourself and your guests, Mr. Robinson and all of you guys, not to put you on the spot, but if you guys are the ones that should put these things out there as exactly what it is. It's concealment fraud. Mm-hmm. It's like old NFL misdirection play.
Don't talk about the NFL.
The public doesn't know it until after the fact. You know, that's why I listen to your show, Mr. Steiner.
Let Clarence finish off real fast, and we'll let you jump right in, Brian. Go ahead, Clarence, finish your thought.
No, I'm finished. Thank you.
Okay, cool. What were you about to say, Brian?
I was just wondering if you had a specific example of something that the media didn't put out until after the fact. Because, you know, again, I'll go back to the gaming thing. I mean, you can Google this and come up with some stories pretty quickly from 2012 dealing with these commercials about where the education funding was going. And, you know, you'll find a number of stories that very clearly before the election point out that the language in the bill just doesn't hold up against the claims in the commercials. And these were claims in commercials made by people who were public officials, like the mayor of Baltimore and the then county executive of Baltimore County, who now works in Baltimore City. These claims just didn't hold up, and it wasn't put out after the fact. At some point, and maybe this is not a popular thing for a reporter to say, but, you know, when these things get written, we've done our job. How do we go house to house and make people read it?
Sure. I can tell you that I have a YouTube channel called C3 Newsman, and one of the first stories that comes up is a story about the gaming and the commercials and what they were trying to do and what was the influence peddling. And, of course, now I'm going to give that shameless plug for Maryland Public Television State Circle on Fridays at 7:30. We do delve into those questions beyond just the superficial, where we bring in the politicians who have to answer questions more or less not just about why but how. And I think, I appreciate Clarence's sentiment, but, you know, look, we do this for a living. And because we do it for a living, we're more attuned to it. But exactly. we also remind folks that, you know, it is a participatory democracy. It is not a one-sided democracy.
Mm-hmm. So, but Natasha, why do you think it's not getting to the people? What is that? Because, I mean, that's probably what you were talking about a moment ago, right?
Because that's actually not the job of a journalist. I actually have a background in journalism. The job of a journalist is to report the news and to, for the most part, compartmentalize what they're reporting in their area. So now there's these blogs, and then you have these alternative news sources. You have major networks. You have, you know, this type of scenario. But that's not the job of the journalist. Now, if the journalist is an activist, that person may then take on the role of making certain that the people are actually getting the right information. If the journalist is a lobbyist, that journalist will then take that information.
We can't be lobbyists.
Exactly. And that's not my point. You can't do it.
We can't be activists.
And you can't. Exactly. That's why I left journalism. But I will tell you, there are some things. There's something. You guys can address this. We're talking about the governor. We're talking about part of the discussion is on his stance in terms of the current climate and his lack of kind of conversation, communication about what he's thinking relative to the current climate. I'll give you an example of something that may or may not be a part of the discussion, but it should be. This is from a criminologist. So we know that Department of Justice is in the process of identifying a new head, right? And we know that in Baltimore particularly, we are directly impacted by what's going to happen with the DOJ, right? So currently, the early consent decree for Baltimore City on page 62 talks about the lack of training on the part of the police department to engage in what was called fair and impartial policing. Okay, now the layperson does not understand what that means. Fair and impartial policing appears to sound like a great way to educate law enforcement professionals on how to engage with people in the community and be fair and impartial. But it actually acknowledges the potential. This is Dr. Friedel, who came up with this fair and impartial policing plan, that says that police officers themselves are not racist. And it says that they only exist in a cloud of bias. And it's called this philosophy of the psychology of bias that lends itself to they're making decisions that trigger something in their brain that lends to bias and not address the issue of race or racism. So one example of how we as academics are actually engaging to help to educate the people is to convene on our campus. We actually have a reading group to address the DOJ report to then take that information in terms of publication, and then share it with our students, and then have forums and the like on our campuses. But again, we do have these varying roles. Some of us are limited in those roles. Journalists are not activists. We already addressed that.
So I just want to, just real quick.
No. We have to take a short break. We're going to come right back.
Okay.
And Clarence, another Clarence, you're the next caller up at 410-319-8888. We want to come back, and we want to look at the issues of the paid sick leave. I'm going to talk about Cheryl Glenn's push around the marijuana licenses and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back, folks. The Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. We're here with Dr. Natasha Pratt-Harris, Assistant Professor in the Department of Sociology at Morgan State University, Brian Sears, Government Reporter for The Daily Record, Charles Robinson, Political and Business Correspondent for Maryland Public Television, as we wrestle with what's happening in Annapolis at 410-319-8888. Going to come to your call in just a minute, Clarence. You can also tweet us here at Mark Steiner. Send an email to talk@steinershow.org. We want to hear what you have to say. But let me talk about what I think is the debate that may not grip the audience as much, even though it might for some people because it affects them very deeply. But as to paid sick leave, and what is the gap between the governor and the Democratic leadership on this bill? Where is the fight?
fight is over numbers, about the number of people who qualify for paid sick leave. The legislature who passed a bill last year in the House but failed in the Senate had a much broader, wider reach in order to capture more people. The governor, I think, looked at the landscape and said, you know what? I'm okay with this, but I want to make the number smaller, and I want to confine it to certain types of industries. And that's become, I've heard both delegates and senators say, you know what? Why doesn't the governor sign on to our bill that we passed last year and we'll tweak it? Because there are some in the legislature who believe that, you know, by putting this in place, you will dampen some small businesses. This does not affect large businesses. It affects small businesses. And I think that's been one of those kind of, where do you want to come down on this? You know?
So, I mean, from what I understand, Brian, so the issues are that the Democrats want it to affect companies with at least 15 workers, right?
Correct.
And the governor wants 50 workers.
Let me kind of hit the numbers here real quick, just some of the broader strokes. So in the plan that was passed last year by the House that ultimately did not pass in the legislative session, the plan would deal with any business with 15 or more employees. I think it roughly gives an hour of paid sick leave for every 7 or 8 worked. I think the maxed out on that is close to 80 hours with some carryover that also maxes out to 80 hours in any given year. So really, you can't have more than 80 hours of paid sick leave. The governor's plan tops out touches at 50 employees or 50 employees or more. They would be required to offer sick leave. His sick leave plan is about the total number of hours is roughly half of what the Democratic plan is. And the other thing that he does is that he offers a tax incentive in order to bring in businesses with employers that have less than 50 employees to get them to come in and do it. And there are Democrats down here who have, including I think Senator Bill Ferguson, who have referred to this as, you know, a giveaway to corporate, you know, to businesses in the order of tens of millions. I think this probably goes to something that Charles mentioned earlier, where there's a little bit of politics here, and there could be some of this, the governor finding a way to win, even if he still loses, and that way will be he comes out and says that he supports sick leave, and I'm not questioning his motivations. He may genuinely support sick leave, and I don't pretend to know what is in the hearts and minds of other men. But it gives him some political wiggle room because he comes out and says, look, this is a more business friendly plan. I agree with the idea of paid sick leave, but I don't want to, he said, he doesn't want to gut businesses in Maryland. And the legislature, if they end up passing their plan that looks, that doesn't look anything like his, he will, it gives him the opportunity if he chooses to veto it while still saying, hey, look, I support the idea. I just think that, or maybe even if he doesn't sign it, he can still say, I support the idea. I just think that this is a wrong plan for Maryland. And so it gives him the opportunity to be for it while simultaneously being against the idea.
It's a strange way of politics, isn't it? It just boggles my mind.
Well, I mean,
I don't know that I would say it's a strange way of politics. I mean, look, the one thing that I think has frustrated Democratic legislators in Maryland over the last 2 years or so is that I think there was this idea that they were going to come to Annapolis after Larry Hogan got sworn in and they were going to Bob Ehrlich him. And they were just going to do to him what they did to Bob Ehrlich, and that Hogan would end up being a one-term governor. And now we're into the third we're into the third year of the term with a governor who's got a 76% a popularity rating. And there are Democrats down here. The message on the opening day of session from Bush and Miller to Democrats and Democratic supporters, was that, they have to find a way to defeat defeat Larry Hogan. And, otherwise he's going to be doing things like redrawing the redistricting maps. And I think that there's a genuine concern from Democrats that Larry Hogan is going to be the first two-term Republican governor since McKelvin.
And it's very possible it's Democrats.
I was going to say, if the election is today, I'd tell you that Larry Hogan's going to win.
So let me open the phones here and also read this tweet that came in, and then I want to come to this, some other questions here before the end of the hour at 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air. Welcome, line two.
I thank all of you for your comments, and I thank you for taking my call. And this is in reference to the lottery. Anybody that remembers, I'm 68 years old, back to the Maryland State Lottery, and they had the same things going on. We're going to do this for the schools. And I disagree with the last caller. You all do your jobs, and as the citizens of Baltimore City, since they're impacted about this a lot, they need to start taking their part in this, be it the police department or the schools, until the citizens understand that they have to push these politicians to do what they are supposed to do. When I lived in Baltimore City, there's a lady, her name is Mary Pat Clark, mm-hmm. and she's still pushing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go sit down and talk to her, if you don't get an answer, she will get it for you. Mm-hmm. And until citizens do their part, you all are doing your part, you all are putting the information out there. If you read, if it's like when the Sun papers, the editorials that were appearing about the casinos, and I guess the public didn't understand. Yes, they had politicians that were getting on TV, but you need to question those politicians. And I thank you all for taking my call.
Clarence, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. And let's also, Melissa tweeted in, Thornton formula probably on way out. Could parents levy the Curbin Commission work as talking point for redirecting casino funds?
That's a possibility. I mean, obviously, you know, understand this. When Thornton was put in place, you know, Dr. Alvin Thornton, I won't call him a character, but he was very forceful in getting them by using this term. These are our babies. And guess what? I always said, you know, that's powerful when you say, as opposed to calling them students or children, call them your babies. You know, that puts the pressure.
But it's not new, Charles. I mean, how many times have we heard down here that this is for the children? It's not a new argument.
Right, but I'm saying he called
it's
them babies.
Argument, okay. But it's not a new argument.
Right. But the whole idea was is that Thornton was kind of pie in the sky. He didn't get everything he wanted, but at the end of the day, he did. And I don't think that whatever comes out of this commission, they don't want to get everything they want. It'll start out in incremental portions. And then the question will be, how do you implement it? And, of course, how do you pay for it? And
that's going to be the biggest question is how to fund it. Because, if, you know, again, I'll go back to the Thornton Commission. Only the first year Thornton was fully paid for, and it was paid for out of cigarette restitution money.
Right.
I think it was roughly a $60 or $75 million note. And it came out of cigarette restitution money. And every year after that, as Thornton phased in and got more expensive, they struggled to find the money.
Right.
And so there was no funding formula that was put in place to back the bills that they were racking up.
And the other part was this geographical index that they put in place in order to give some jurisdictions more money because other jurisdictions didn't need as much money. I mean, the whole idea, I think, sometimes is you fund everybody equally. Well, I want to say if you're down on the eastern shore, $20 million is a lot of money. It can do a lot of things. But that's $20 million. Maybe half of that could have gone to Baltimore, and you still would have gotten the same results down there.
So let's talk about Baltimore for a moment. And one of the things that that Charles posited early on, that there was a shift in power, though you talk to some state senators and delegates, maybe they're just in a good mood, talking about they feel themselves in an alliance with Baltimore, and maybe they do, maybe they don't. But the issue is we have the city school issue here. There are all the issues around the law officers' Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And how much weight do we think that's going to have in Annapolis? How much of this would move off a dime? What do you think, Natasha?
Well, again, as a citizen of the state of Maryland, professor in Baltimore City, product of this system in terms of our public school system, the expectation is that there will be a prioritized issue relative to our schools and our police departments. I just, there's this thing that's bringing me, and it has been, this sense of optimism and hope that the politics will take a back seat to actually acknowledging children as actual children, or babies as actually being our babies. You know, the previous caller talked about the responsibility of the people to make certain that they understand what's happening, and, you know, if the law or policy is actually benefiting them, or what they're seeing on a commercial is actually accurate. But, you know, that process in terms of understanding that comes from how we're even teaching these young people in our schools. So, again, I'm optimistic. A good friend here is saying that, you know, these things might not be priority, but we can't escape the memory of what happened just shy two years ago, and acknowledging where we are in our climate. Right now, we're talking about denying refugees and seriously and heavily vetting a refugee, but we haven't been talking about, you know, reform relative to seriously and heavily vetting police officers, or seriously and heavily vetting officers who are actually on the beat now, who we know have been problematic. So knowing these actual stories, hearing from actual persons who are lobbying in Annapolis to discuss these very issues, my expectation that this won't be a back burner issue.
So let me ask you this, Brian, where do you think the Baltimore issue is going to go?
Look, I don't get paid for sort of making predictions, but I will give you some insight into how the board sort of sets up. And I think Mayor Catherine Pugh comes into her first legislative session as the leader of Baltimore with a lot of goodwill. She has great working relationships in the legislature, and she and Larry Hogan both describe each other warmly as friends. And so I think that those things play to her advantage. Mm-hmm. There are a number of other issues here. One of those issues, for example, is the repeated deficits in the Baltimore City school system. You know, this year it's $129 million. You know, this is not a new or unusual thing. And I don't speak for the governor, but based on what I've observed over the last 2 years, this is a governor who demands accountability, and I think would probably be willing to help any organization or jurisdiction, but is going to have questions about why the school system continues to, you know, to lose money and be in a deficit situation. $129 million, you know, it's almost real money down here. I think that's
$129 million is real money.
There are going to be questions about that. But I do think that she's got a tremendous asset in her good working relationship, especially with the Senate president. And with the,
say that again, Brian. We just lost you for a second.
Oh, well, I'll pick up.
Wait, Brian, you there?
Mark.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Say that over what you just said. I'm sorry. Then we'll go right to
Charlie. I think that the mayor has some tremendous assets, and those start with her relationships with the Senate president and the governor. And so I think that Natasha's right to be hopeful. Although I think based on what I heard Natasha say, I guess I'd like to ask her, you know, with all the conversation that's been going on with Democrats focusing on pushing Hogan to respond to whatever is going on at the federal level, do you think that the Democrats down here are spending enough time with their eye on the ball talking about education and policing issues in Baltimore City, or are they letting that slide to score political points by trying to tie the governor to the new president?
I think pretty much we suffer from the same amnesia that lay people suffer from, you know, just forgetting what is actually happening, or because you're not connected to the experience of the people, it doesn't affect you directly. It doesn't affect your family. So it's not on your radar. But clearly it is still an issue. And those who are out consistently engaging with the people who are actually advocates have consistently acknowledged that.
Here's the good news for Baltimore City residents. I think Larry Hogan, at least from his aides that I've talked to him, who I've talked to, have indicated that they would like to get the city school problems off their agenda. Mm-hmm. In fact, the current mayor, Catherine Pugh, has said she would like to take over the schools again. I think that would have happened if they had a balanced budget this year, but because of that deficit, they're not prepared to let this go, because they send a lot of money to Baltimore City. And the fact that they're not good managers of the money makes it difficult for the city of Baltimore to take re-control of the school system.
But it's not all on, I mean, A, Sonia Santelisa, as the CEO of schools, walked into this mess. She
yes,
didn't create
she did.
The mess.
She did not create the mess.
Right? A. And B, B, part of it has to do with how this formula is beginning to work, where you see
The so-called ghost students. I don't understand.
No, I'm talking about that either. I'm talking about the reality of the wealth building of Baltimore and property, which has gone to lessen the money coming to city schools in Baltimore. Because that wealth has no relationship to the poverty that kids come from in the school system.
Right.
There's a huge disconnect there. Mm-hmm. There are lots of reasons why this deficit is here, and it's a complex one.
I think the governor wants to get this off of the state's rolls because it.
Well, that's not going to happen, though.
I know, but I'm just giving you what I'm hearing from people, that they see this problem in Baltimore as, you know what, I really don't want to deal with this anymore. Let these folks deal with it.
So it's you, Brian. Is this going to be a question of politics, or is it going to be a question of really trying? Is the debate going to be centered around the unspoken political campaign in 2018?
Look, I don't think you can ignore the. First of all, I don't think it's an unspoken campaign. I mean, we are. You know, I think the governor has been in campaign mode since he got sworn in. He ran a 4-year campaign. disrespect to the governor. The governor ran a very calculated, disciplined 4-year campaign to be governor, and he has shown no signs of being any less disciplined during his term. You go to the old joke, you know, what does every one-term governor want a second term? I don't think Larry Hogan's any different. And, you know, he's got a portrait of McKeldin outside of his office. He was sworn in on the McKeldin Bible. That's more than just sort of, you know, a nod to the past. I think he really wants to see his legacy as a successor to McKeldin, and that at this stage of the game is within reach. I think politics in Annapolis are always going to be part of the conversation, whether anybody wants to admit it or not. But I do think that there's the possibility, and again, I'll go back to Kathy Pugh's relationships down here. There is the possibility to make some changes and to get some of the things that she wants, but I still think it's going to come down to having to answer some tough questions about whether or not any particular organization as being a good steward of significant amounts of public money. That is a conversation that this Republican governor has had repeatedly with any number of organizations, including departments within his purview.
So one other little thing here, Mark, and it's something that this governor has been able to tap into. Remember how I told you he usurps Democratic ideas? This opioid heroin epidemic. And that always, first of all, I didn't think he was genuine about this until I heard him talk about his cousin who died from an overdose. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, that's genuine. But every time I ask him about this question, well, where were you? Heroin has been in Baltimore since the 20s.
Not connected.
Yeah. And I said, is it because all of a sudden it's in the suburbs? Well, as someone, a friend of mine told me, he said, Charles, it's about how you deal with the issue.
But you know, but one question I have about that is it's not, that's a mythology, though. It's not always been just in Baltimore. I mean, anybody who's been covering this issue for any amount of time or lived in the city knows that over half the people who come to buy the heroin are white people who live in the counties,
right.
Not black folks in the city who are looking for heroin.
Right.
I mean, so there's always been a heroin epidemic in Baltimore County and Harford County and Anne Arundel County. It's always been there. It's not like this just happened last year. It's always been there.
Right.
I mean, this is not. It's just,
but it's a popular. It's a populist.
Exactly.
It's a populist idea.
Mm-hmm. Right, but let me. Okay. I got you. Yeah. But I just think that we're. You know, it's. It's part of that reasoning is because there have been all these ODs, and because we have taken money out over the last 40 years in drug treatment across the state,
and now
people are clamoring to put it back in.
Right.
And I think that's part of what it is, because it's affecting communities outside of Baltimore City. But it's always been there. I mean, would you disagree with that, Brian? I mean, heroin addicts are not confined to Baltimore City, nor opiate addicts.
I think that's always been true.
Yeah. So let me ask this question before we get this last caller in here. Cheryl Glenn's, at the head of the Black Caucus.
Yes.
Putting in the issue, dealing with the issue around who got these licenses to grow and distribute medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, when we covered that in the beginning, one of the things that was glaring to me was the lack of minorities, lack of black folks who around the state who were part of any of these consortiums. So, you know, and that was a real issue, and it proved to be true. Mm-hmm. So where does this go? Does Cheryl Glenn have any power here with the Black Caucus in Annapolis to make a change here?
She has some numbers, but the question begins with, if you decide that the original process was flawed, get ready for lawsuits, okay? Because we already got some, okay? So the other question is, do you reopen it to a wider group and allow some of the people who did not get licensees to get in? And that's probably one of the ways they can do this. But once again, you know, Hogan's talking about an opioid heroin crisis, and we got this marijuana thing.
Exactly. And contradiction.
You know, the contradictions.
Why is that a contradiction?
Yeah. Well, not so much a contradiction.
It's a contradiction.
A contradiction.
Why
is
it a contradiction?
Drugs make money. Yeah. Let's just be
right.
candid.
Yeah.
Drugs make money. And
okay, but I'm going to come back to the focus of the issue here, which is, right. Does it have, Brian, do you think it has legs in Annapolis to reopen this? And one of the things when I question Republican delegates and senators, mm-hmm. is you guys are for the free market. Why are you limiting it to just a few people? Why don't you open it up and allow the marketplace to flourish?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a couple of questions in here, and I'll try and hit them real quick. So does it have legs? I think it's certainly going to be a point for discussion. There are some real thorny issues here, including how did in anything that's going to slow down one more day getting this medicine into the hands of patients. Going to your question of free market, there were a lot of legislators, and again, Bobby Zirkin told me, you know, he was one that favored the idea of opening it up and just letting anybody who qualified for a license have a license and then let the market decide. There were a number of people who wanted to do that. That just wasn't the side that prevailed for any number of reasons. And so, at this point, the toothpaste is out of the tube. We are significantly into this process. We've started issuing licenses, and I'm not clear at this point what the legislative solution is, but it's definitely going to get talked about, and so in that respect, it's got legs.
So, and a quick thought on that, Natasha, before we hit this last caller on the phone.
Note about contradiction. 5 years ago, number one reason black males were detained at the Baltimore Juvenile Justice Center was for marijuana possession. That has since been decriminalized. The heroin addicts of today, Baltimore City particularly, are still criminalized. Then we're talking about addressing this for the larger spectrum of people who need the treatment, and the whole notion of criminalization versus medical realities for people. It's a major contradiction.
Let's go to the phones. We have two minutes left. Ernest? Yep. Ernest, a very quick thought. Sorry, man, we're up against the clock.
Well, I don't think, good afternoon. I don't think nobody's stealing funds, because if anyone was stealing funds, after all these years, they would have been in jail by now. The federal government would have prosecuted them.
I agree.
The other thing is this. I heard your interview with the FOP, former FOP president?
Yes.
And wasn't he this guy that had the rat put on his car? He went to him. He said he went to Bob Cherry and said that, told him that they were trying to get him put a rat on his car. And they did not protect him. He had to leave the police department. And the other thing is the war on drugs. Let's not get it mixed up. The war on drugs was a war on black people.
All right, Ernest.
African Americans, started by this U.S. government.
I always appreciate your voice. Sorry, we are up against the clock. I want to thank our guests for being here today. Brian Sears, government reporter for the Daily Record. Thank you so much for joining us today, as usual.
Thank you, sir.
Charles Robinson, political and business correspondent for Maryland Public Television.
Appreciate it.
Good to have you here. And Dr. Natasha Pratt Harris, assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Morgan State University. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you all here. And reminding only the WAD here, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From limiting overtesting to protecting public school funding, you can learn more about the issues facing Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or SteinerShow.org is Maryland State Education Association's banner. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our intern is Morgan State Senior Michael Dixon. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program too. Talk at SteinerShow.org and to podcast the Steiner Show and share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at SteinerShow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.